Once there was a man who had a refractory cow that would not bear the yoke for the plough, but always shook it from her neck. The man took her calf from her and brought it to the field which was to be ploughed. When the cow heard the lowing of her calf, she let herself be driven to the field and submitted her neck to the yoke. The calf is on the field. The man has brought it hither. Yet it lows not, rather makes no sound as it looks about in the strange field, which it thinks to be a field of the dead. It is too soon, thinks the calf, to let its voice be heard. But it has a clear idea of the man's purpose and long-distance calculations, this calf Jehoseph, or Osarsif. Knowing the man, it assumes at once and understands, though as in a dream, that its transportation to this field, so rebelled against at home, is no isolated fact or half-measure, but part of a plan, in which one thing follows upon another. This theme of the following on, or the drawing after, is one of those which presented themselves contrapuntally in his intelligent and dreamy soul, in which, as one may say, the sun and the moon, as we sometimes see them, are in the sky at the same time, and the moon comes into play as the leading motif, making a gleaming path for its brothers the constellations across the sky. Joseph the calf. Had he not had his own thoughts at sight of the bright meadows of the land of Goshen, quite irrespective of the man's plans, though even so in harmony with them? Premature thoughts they were, and wide-ranging into the future. He saw that himself, and for the present they should remain unuttered, for much was yet to be fulfilled before they could come to fulfillment, and the mere coming hither was by no means enough. Something more must be added, to which there was need of the quietest waiting and the most childlike and secretive caution. Withal, no speculation at all as to the how, for that lay with the man who brought the calf to the field. That lay with God. No, Joseph was not unmindful of the old man at home, benumbed by his grief. His silence, the silence of so many years, must never lead us to reproach him. Least of all at this moment, the events of which I relate with emotions precisely like his own, for they are his own. I feel, indeed, as though I had once already reached this point in my story, and told it once before. The special feeling of recognition, of having been here before and dreamed the same dream, moves me and challenges me to dwell upon it. And such precisely were the feelings, such the experience, of my hero. For all which, there is probably very good reason. What I am tempted to call his bond with his father, a bond the stronger and deeper in that thanks to far-reaching associations it was also a bond with God, was in particular strength at this moment. As indeed, how could it not have been, when it subsisted in him, with him, and outside of him? What he felt was imitation and succession. With slight differences, his father before him had experienced the same. It is uncanny to see the mixture of free will and guidance in the phenomenon of imitation. In the end, it is hard to tell whether it is the individual or the destiny that actually follows the pattern and insists upon the repetition. The inward and the outward play into each other and materialize apparently without active will into the event which was from all time bound up with and one with the individual. For we move in the footsteps of others, and all life is but the pouring of the present into the forms of the myth. Joseph played with many forms of imitation and artlessly deluding self-metamorphoses, knowing how to make an impression with them and win men to himself, even if temporarily. But just now, he was entirely preoccupied with the return of the father idea and its resurrection in him. He was Jacob the father, a refugee from home, fleeing before fraternal hate, stolen to the kingdom of Laban to escape from the Red One's jealousy of the firstborn blessing. This time, to be sure, there was not one Esau, but 10, and Laban's present form was quite other than the old one. He was Potiphar, tamer of horses, arriving in a chariot with fiery wheels, arrayed in royal linen, fat and heavy, and so brave that one must tremble for his life. But Laban he was, all the same, no doubt of that, however much life changed its forms. And once more, as the past had foretold, had the seed of Abram come a stranger into the land that belonged not to him, and Joseph was to serve a Laban, who in his present form bore an Egyptian name and a high-flown title like Gift of the Sun. But how long should he serve him? Thus did we ask in the time of Jacob, and made the matter clear to the light of reason. Now we ask it with regard to the son, again with intent to clarify the matter and establish the dream within the reality. In Joseph's story, the question of time and age have always been very laxly dealt with in the field of reality. Dreamy and superficial fantasy ascribes to his figure an unchangeableness untouched by time, such as it had in Jacob's eyes when he believed him to be dead and mangled. But that is an unchangeableness only conferred by death. Actually, the lad, immortalized to the father's eye, lived on and increased in years. We need to realize that the Joseph before whose chair the famine-stricken brethren stood and made obeisance was a 40-year-old man, and that they failed to recognize him not only on account of his dress and his dignity of rank, but also because of the changes wrought by the years in his person. 23 years had passed since the Esau brethren had sold him into Egypt, almost as much time as Jacob all in all spent in the land of nevermore return. And the same name might with even more justice be given to the country where now Abram's seed was once more strange, for the years which Joseph remained in it were not 14 and 6 and 5, or 7 and 13 and 5, but actually the whole of his life, and only with his death did he return home. But it has remained uncertain, and has been little considered, in what proportion the years of his underworld life were divided into the two plain and clear epochs of his blessing life. The first and decisive period of his sojourn in Potiphar's house, and the period spent in the pit, whither he once more came. The two periods came, together, to 13 years, the same number that Jacob took to rear up his 12 Mesopotamian children. Supposing that Joseph was 30 when his head was lifted up, and he became the first among those below. Certainly, we are nowhere told that that was his age, or at least nowhere where the statement would be authoritative. Yet it is a generally accepted fact, nonetheless, an axiom requiring no evidence, and simply speaking for itself, begetting itself, as it were, like the sun from its own mother, and with the clearest claims to a simple, "so it was." For it is always so. 30 years is just the right age for the stage of life at which Joseph then arrived. At 30, a man emerges from the darkness and wilderness of the time of preparation into active life. It is the age of fruition and fulfillment. 13 years then passed from the time when he entered Egypt, a 17-year-old lad, to the day when he stood before Pharaoh. There can be no doubt of it. But how many of them were spent in Potiphar's house, and how many in the grave? The established tradition leaves it open. A few non-committal phrases are all we have to help us clear up the dates within our history. How shall we interpret them? What shall we conclude was the real division of the time? The question seems inept. Do we know our story, or do we not? Is it proper and suitable to the nature of storytelling that the narrator should openly reckon dates and facts according to any deductions or considerations whatever? Should he appear at all, save as anonymous source of the tale which is being told or is telling itself, in which everything is, by virtue of itself, so, and not otherwise, indisputable and certain? The narrator, according to this view, should be in the tale, one with it, and not outside it, reckoning and calculating. But how is it with God, whom Abram thought into being and recognized? He is in the fire, but he is not the fire. Thus he is at once in it and outside it. Indeed, it is one thing to be a thing, quite another to observe it. And yet there are planes and spheres where both happen at once. The narrator is in the story, yet is not the story. He is its scene, but it is not his, since he is also outside it, and by a turn of his nature puts himself in the position of dealing with it. I've never tried to produce the illusion that I am the source of the history of Joseph. Before it could be told, it happened. It sprang from the source from which all history springs, and tells itself as it goes. Since that time, it exists in the world. Everybody knows it, or thinks he does. For often enough the knowledge is unreal, casual, and disjointed. It had been told 100 times in 100 different mediums, and now it is passing through another, wherein, as it were, it becomes conscious of itself and remembers how things actually were with it in the long ago, so that it now both pours forth and speaks of itself as it pours. It tells, for instance, about the apportionment of the years between Joseph's sale to Potiphar and the lifting up of his head. And this much is certain, that the Joseph who went down into the prison was far from being the lad Joseph whom the Ishmaelites led before Petiphar's house, that much the larger part of the 13 years was passed in that house. I might state the fact categorically, but prefer merely to inquire how it could have been otherwise. Joseph was, from a social point of view, a complete cipher, when, as a 17 or 18-year-old youth, he came among the Egyptians, and his career there must have embraced the whole time of his stay. For it was not on the 2nd or the 3rd day of it that Potiphar set the Shabarite slave over the whole of his property and left it in Joseph's hands. It took some time before the master was even aware of Joseph's presence, and the same is true of certain other persons of importance to the issue of events. Moreover, that swiftly mounting career to the great height he reached must, even so, have stretched into years in order to be the schooling in administration and economics which we are led to consider it. In a word, Joseph stayed with Potiphar for 10 years, and became a man of 27, a Hebrew man, as it is said of him, by some, even a Hebrew servant, which sounds rather distorted and exaggerated, considering that in practice he had long since ceased to be a servant. We cannot tell or define the precise point at which he ceased to be so, as little now as we could have done then. In legal fact, Joseph remained a servant, a slave, even at the time of his greatest honor, and actually until the end of his life, for we read of his being sold, and of his being sold again, but nowhere at all of his being freed. His phenomenal career ignored the legal fact of his status, and after his swift elevation, it no longer came in question. Even in the house of Petiphar, he did not long remain a slave in any strict sense of the word. His rise to Eliezer's position of stewardship by no means occupied the whole of his time there. One thing is certain, that 7 years were enough. Another, that it was only the remaining 3 which were dominated and overshadowed by the emotions of an unhappy woman, and which brought in their train the termination of the decade. The tradition does, by its very vagueness in the matter of time, indicate that the trouble did not begin at once, or even very soon after Joseph's appearance, that it did not coincide with his rise to power, but only commenced after he had reached his height. After these things, it says, it came to pass, in other words, after its own account of Joseph's rise to a position of the highest trust. That unhappy passion, then, must be thought of as lasting 3 years, quite long enough for the actors in it, before the final catastrophe. The results of our examination of this part of the story are borne out by the other half. We have calculated that the Potiphar episode occupied 10 years of Joseph's life. Accordingly, there are 3 years left for the period in prison, no more and no less. And certainly it is not often that fact and probability coincide more nearly than in this case. For what could be more illuminating, more inevitable, than that Joseph lay 3 years in the prison, no more and no less, corresponding to the 3 days which he lay in the well at Dothan? We may even go so far as to assert that he suspected it beforehand, or even knew it, and measuring it by all that he held fitting, significant, and in the divine order of things, was convinced that nothing else was possible, confirmed therein by a destiny which took a perfectly inevitable line. 3 years. And not only that it was 3, but also that it could not be otherwise. The tradition fixes with extraordinary precision and detail the way in which the 3 years were divided. It shows that the famous episodes of the chief baker and the chief butler, Joseph's elegant fellow prisoners, upon whom he waited, fell in the first year. At the end of 2 full years, it says, Pharaoh dreamed, and Joseph interpreted unto him his dreams. 2 full years after what? Opinions might differ. It might mean 2 years after he became Pharaoh, that is, 2 years after the accession of that Pharaoh who dreamed the riddling dreams. Or, on the other hand, it might mean 2 years after Joseph had interpreted the dreams of the butler and the baker, and the latter, as we know, had been hanged. But it would come to the same thing in the end. Pharaoh dreamed his dreams 2 years after the episodes of the imprisoned courtiers, and also 2 years after he had become Pharaoh. For during the time Joseph spent in prison, at the end of the first year, to be precise, it came to pass that Amunhotep, of his name the third, united himself with the sun. And his son, the dreamer, set upon his head the double crown. Thus we see that there is nothing wrong about the story, but that all the evidence agrees concerning the 10 and 3 years of Joseph's life until he was 30. The true and the actual are one. In the Land of the Moderns. Part of the game we play with life consists in the relations of human beings one to another. Take 2 people who have just exchanged their first glance. What could be slighter? What could be more unconscious, tenuous, distant, and casual than the bond between them? And yet it may be destined to take on, some unimaginable day, a character of burning intensity, a frightful and breathtaking immediacy. Truly this game, and the innocence of the players, may well be the subject of head-shaking and pondering on the part of the forewarned observer.